I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Violent crime is a big issue in the city, so much so that the Department of Justice took notice last month, announcing plans to send resources to help local law enforcement. Today, the state of public safety in Kansas City. From what other cities can teach us to reducing homicides to greater transparency in the police department, we'll get a preview of the public safety issues that KCUR will be following in 2020. Then, in the 70s, fast food franchises became a way for blacks to own and run a business in their neighborhoods. The history of fast food, black capitalists, and civil rights leaders on Up to Date after this hour's news. No question that 2019 was a rough year for homicides in both Kansas City, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas. The question in 2020 is, what are officials going to do about it? One thing they are going to do about it is to incorporate new tactics now used successfully by police in Milwaukee and Tampa. KCUR reporters will be watching closely as the year unfolds to determine just how effective those responses turn out to be and what more needs to be done. Joining us now to talk about the state of public safety are two reporters who work at KCUR. They are Sam Zeff. Sam, always good to have you.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
And Chris Haxel, who is connected with the Guns in America Public Media Collaborative. Chris, good morning to you.
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
You know, I think a lot of area residents recognize what the problem is here, Sam. To what extent are we going to see law enforcement trying something new, new techniques in 2020?
Well, there's a series of things. First of all, the Crimes Against Persons Unit has a new major. They've put 8 more detectives into the homicide unit. They killed the Mountain Unit to do that, to get those 8 positions.
No more horses.
Yeah. There's no more horses. There are 0 horses in the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department now. There has been movement within the mayor's office to sue, to try gun makers, to make it more difficult to get guns. So there's any number of issues. None of them are particularly new. None of them of those are particularly innovative. So we're going to have to wait and see. They've also put more detectives into the assault unit. They had a 43% clearance rate for homicides in Kansas City. That's very poor. The clearance rate for aggravated assaults, people, what they call bullet to skin, people who've been shot, that clearance rate is probably half of that.
These are incidents that, but for the grace of God, could have turned into homicides.
Right. You know, the cops will call. They'll just say those are failed homicides, right? Nobody is firing at you hoping to hit you in the leg or the shoulder, right? Those are failed homicides. And those aggravated assaults with guns, that clearance rate is even less. So they put more detectives into the assault squad. But it's going to be months, I think, Steve, before we figure out or before we see whether any of this is going to work.
Chris Haxel, I mentioned in the opening about Milwaukee and Tampa, Florida, and maybe Kansas City borrowing some techniques from those cities. What do those departments have to teach the two Kansas cities here?
Well, Steve, those trips, first of all, were funded through this public safety partnership, which is a federal program through the Department of Justice. It's sort of like, I don't want to say time out, but it's for cities that have violent crime problems, and it's to help give them opportunities to learn from other departments that have been successful. So Milwaukee, for example, has this program. They call it basically a shoot review program. So once a week, they'll sit down and review every shooting that has taken place. And they're doing it not just with police, but they'll bring in federal partners. They'll bring in people from the local prosecutor's office. I believe they bring in people from other like city agencies, such as the health department.
Right.
And this has been around in Milwaukee for a while. They had some starts and some stops, but they sort of re-implemented it recently. And they've had a lot of success. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, Milwaukee had, I believe, 147 homicides, which is almost identical to the 148 Kansas City had last year. The last 2 years, Milwaukee has been under 100.
Hey, what do these reviews offer police? What kind of insight does it give them that leads to a lower homicide count down the road?
Think of it like a post-mortem that a doctor might do after someone dies. The idea is these partners sit down and they try to figure out what happened and what went wrong. And were there any missed opportunities? Was there anything they could have done differently that may have changed this outcome, whether that's an hour before the shooting or a year or 10 years before the shooting?
And Kansas City is going to try this going forward.
Something along those lines. I mean, they haven't fully announced all of the details. I was watching this morning the Kansas City Police Board Commission. They were talking about a little bit. They did have their first meeting last Wednesday. So they have fully implemented it. I'm sure it will evolve over time and hopefully grow, you know, more robust if it proves to be successful.
You know, Sam Ziff, one of the questions that I ask often during these conversations about violence in our town is this issue and this question of, do we know definitively why violent crime is so prevalent here in Kansas City? I'm not sure I've ever gotten an answer to that question.
I don't think there is one answer. I think it depends on who you talk to. The police will say that it's not just a policing issue. It is a social welfare issue that good schools, good neighborhoods, good roads, job opportunities always lower the crime rate. So there's not it's not always on them. Mayor Lucas, those in the city council, there are those, some in the city council, who would say it's gun laws in Missouri, that it's much harder now to take guns off the street. Still, Kansas City, Missouri Police Department takes some 300 guns a month off the street in Kansas City. But because of the constitutional carry, which is how they refer to it now, even if they pull you over and there's a gun sitting on the seat, you've got no, you know, there's no warrants. There's, you know, you're not being stopped for a crime. You can have that. You can have that gun there. So I think that it's. I think it's a very complicated mix of how you fix it. There's not just one answer.
You just made mention of something that also intrigues me a little bit, this idea that the police department is solely responsible for reducing violent crime. You know, most people now say that's not even close to being the case.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's analogous to hoping that school districts can solve all the ills for the kids in their school district. It is a very complicated mixture of things. Certainly, the police can do things to help. One of the other things they're doing is they're bringing in some new software that they've been using in Atlantic City that is somewhat predictive of where they think crime may occur. Hmm. And it's not just past crime. It could be it's a combination of things. It could be more crime happens on, you know, where there's variety stores, Quick Trips and such, where there's dollar stores sometimes. So this software, which they've been using in Atlantic City, and it was developed at Rutgers University in New Jersey, is sort of, they hope will be sort of predictive, so that you can better deploy the resources that they have.
You know, Chris, I wonder about the level of frustration out in our two communities as this violence continues and even grows, arguably, seemingly year after year. What are you sensing from citizens, from police, from community leaders? What's the tale of frustration out there?
Steve, I don't think the frustration or maybe despair is a better word ever goes away on the part of the community. I do think Kansas City police don't have as great of a relationship with the community as some other cities. You know, earlier you were asking about Milwaukee and Tampa. Well, Tampa, for example, I know has made a long-term effort to engage the community and to develop relationships with the community.
And if the police department was sitting here, they'd say the same thing. They show up at community meetings. They try to engage in a whole host of different ways. Maybe you're suggesting that outreach isn't as deep and as penetrating as it needs to be.
I mean, that's certainly one argument. You know, another issue that has come up nationally is body cameras and trust. And Kansas City Police Department does not have any officer-worn body cameras. I think that has helped some communities across the country build trust, you know, with their police department, because they can see what actually happened, as opposed to, you know, if someone is shot by police, you know, unless it happens to happen in front of a squad car,
right,
we have no record of it.
You know, Chris, the problem has become so bad. I mentioned in the opening that the federal government is now stepping in through the Department of Justice with this increased presence. What can we expect from the Department of Justice? What will they bring to this issue?
Two things. So the first is that they're going to send what Attorney General William Barr called a surge of federal officers into the seven cities, or in the case of Kansas City, it's both sides of the state line, into the region. And that means more actual ATF officers, more FBI officers, more DEA agents. Now, it's not clear entirely whether that means hiring new people, pulling them from other cities. Some of those may not necessarily be sworn law enforcement officers. They might be analysts, that sort of thing. So that's the first part. The second part is essentially a pot of money, which it's not necessarily going to be evenly divided amongst the seven cities. The way it works is they're making this money available through a grant program.
Mm-hmm.
And so each city, Kansas City police are going to have to negotiate with their counterparts on the other side of the state line and other agencies in the area to kind of decide who's going to apply for what. But that money can be used for both equipment and as matching grants to fund salaries for new positions.
But it isn't like these federal officers will be patrolling the streets, though, right? These are behind-the-scenes kinds of people.
It's hard to say exactly. So far, details are pretty lax. It's likely that some Kansas City officers are going to be added to federal task forces. And those task forces do tend to patrol the streets with specific, anti-gun or anti-drug missions that are sort of separate from what the police department's doing.
Sam?
Yeah, those task forces, and they've been around for a long time. A lot of them are run out of the FBI. There's a gang task force, a gun task force, a drug task force. These task forces bring in both federal agents and also local law enforcement, and some of this money would go to pay for some of these local law enforcement salaries and overtime when they go to these federal task force. They've been around for a long time, and the question would be how just adding more task force agents and detectives, is that gonna really help? And we're not sure. I mean, this is not the first time the DOJ has come into Kansas City with a pot of money, and here we are talking about just how bad things are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking this morning about public safety as part of KCUR's ongoing State of Kansas City series, laying markers for different issues that we're going to be covering closely throughout 2020. You know, Sam, the mayor, Quentin Lucas, is saying he wants to bring the homicide count below 100. He's putting a lot of political capital on the line here for a problem that, no one in city government can really control. How big a risk is he taking?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's saying all the right things. He's spending some political capital at a time where he has, I think, a lot of political capital. But remember, Kansas City has very little control over the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. So I think Quentin Lucas is doing what he can with lawsuits, trying to get help from Governor Parson. I mean, I think that he's forged a pretty good relationship with the governor. How far that's going to get him with the Missouri General Assembly is an entirely different question, but I think that the relationship is good. So the political, there doesn't seem to be a political risk right now. The real question is, because Kansas City does not control the police department on a day-to-day basis, there's very little that he can do. Does he want the homicide count to be below 100? I think everybody wants the homicide count to be below 100.
But you're saying if he doesn't get it, there's a consequence for that you think will be minimal.
I think it will be at least this year.
Because his heart's in the right place. He's trying to do the right thing. He's doing what he can.
Yeah. Right. He is doing what he can. But I don't think he's got unlimited time. I think that we have to start seeing some results this year, or he will be part of that group of people who are being held responsible, which I think includes the governor, the legislature, the Kansas, Missouri Police Commission, and Chief Rick Smith. I think if you can't get this thing down this year, if you can't show some progress, I think there's going to be some political capital. I think there's going to be a price to be paid.
Dealing with violence, that's our topic here this morning. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Let's go to some phone calls here and go to Gabriel from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
You're well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to call and make a note. The guest stated that you can carry a firearm openly on your car seat, and there's nothing the police can do about it, and that, and because of constitutional carry. And I just wanted to make a note on that you cannot carry your firearm openly on your seat, and the cops can't do anything about it. That's actually illegal. That's and constitutional carry only covers you carrying your firearm on your person.
That's interesting. Okay.
Concealed.
Sound right, Chris? You're the expert here.
Yeah, I mean, constitutional carry is also referred to as permitless carry, and the idea is essentially that you don't need a permit, or you have a quote-unquote constitutional right to carry your firearm, as the caller said, in a concealed state.
Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls here, and Tom from Kansas City, Missouri. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. I've called once before on this. We have a persistent problem. Like, in December, we had 3 active gun battles in our neighborhood. We can identify who's doing it. They just will not come out. They say, come down and file a police report because they're now gone. We file police reports. You might as well throw them in the trash. And we've been filing police reports like crazy. We need neighborhood policing. We need an officer who's assigned to an area who gets to know the neighborhood and the people. This idea of drive-by and calling people out from different areas. We're right by the Linwood Police Station. We can't get any response from the Linwood Police Station or anyone. It's just like we're the forgotten people east of Troost. Unless they want to give us a ticket or a hard time, even for law-abiding. That's all I got to say.
Thanks, Tom. The forgotten people east of Cruz, Chris.
Yeah, Steve. I mean, one thing I learned in talking to Tampa police after Kansas City kind of announced that they were going down and learning some tactics from there, which was really surprising to me, which is that these days, most of the service calls Tampa police make are proactive, meaning they aren't necessarily responding to calls from people. They're going out into the community and, you know, sort of proactively, whether that's investigating crime or just initiating contact with citizens. And it didn't always used to be that way. It used to be what probably Kansas City and many other cities are like, which is that police are chasing calls all day. Now, of course, Tampa is a different city and has different circumstances, but they've had just kind of a remarkable turnaround on their violent crime problem. And a big part of that is this focus on that community, that neighborhood policing.
That's really interesting. You just wonder how citizens here would react to that, because the knee-jerk response is to call 911 when you sense something amiss in your neighborhood.
Right. And as this caller mentioned, I mean, if there's a community police officer, some officer who already comes by your neighborhood and is giving you their business card, or you've had conversations with them, if you have a problem, maybe you're going to call them instead of just the dispatchers at 911.
Yeah. One of the things that Rick Smith reinstated was community officers who their job is to go into the community. But the police will tell you, and I've written about this, that they feel like they're just running from job to job to job. They're getting gunshot calls.
Right.
I've been out with the cops where they're just going from gunshot call to gunshot call to gunshot call.
To what end is Chris's point based on what you're
hearing
from
Tampa? And the police, you know, are asking for 30 more officers in their proposed budget. And the real question is, do they need, does KCPD need more officers? The police department would argue that they do. The mayor would suggest that they don't need 30 more. There are some in council who don't think they need that many more officers. But it is very reactive as opposed to what Chris just described in Tampa.
Well, it's interesting. Do you need 30 more? Do you need 100 more? Do you need 500 more? I mean, who's to say what the number is?
Well, it's
I know there are
police
formulas out
police
there.
Experts would suggest that it's not so much how many you have, but how they're deployed. Do they need, for example, more detectives? Do they need a second shift at the crime lab so they can move evidence more quickly? The other thing about Kansas City is that it is spread out over 300 square miles.
Right.
So even if you have a lot of cops, especially in the Northland, the response time is going to be a little bit longer because of that.
You know, Chris, in Kansas City, the mayor has talked about finding ways to better protect witnesses of violent crimes, who these folks often fear for their lives if people think they've talked to authorities. What do you expect that could happen there in 2020?
I think we'll see some movement for sure, because it's not just the mayor talking about this. It's the Jackson County prosecutor.
The governor's mentioned it.
Governor Mike Parson, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this is something that the governor has kind of given full-throated support of this. Unlike the He's given less support for actual new gun control legislation.
This is safer political turf.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, we'll have to wait and see exactly how much funding the state's going to make available. We're going to have to see how it gets set up. But I do believe we'll see some movement on that this year.
Sam, the other thing you hear talk about for 2020 is this rising focus on mental health and what to do on that front. Do you get a sense society is focusing more in that direction? What might that translate to in 2020?
There's no specific proposals out there to deal with that. There is some movement within the prosecutor's office to provide mental health services and wraparound services to gunshot victims. But how are you going to come up with a matrix where you can predict who is going to become violent because of some mental health issues? Those in the mental health community would also argue that very few crimes are committed by people who have mental health problems. So how are they going to deal with it? There's nothing specific out there right now.
You know, some related issues on the horizon this year, Chris. Kansas City, Kansas is looking for a new police chief who should come on board at some point this year. Who will this new chief replace, and what are the challenges that this individual is going to face here?
He's going to be replacing the former KCK police chief, Terry Ziegler, who stepped down. I believe it's now been a couple months. And we haven't really heard much about who's going to be replacing him or about the process for finding a successor, let alone naming one. So I think the big question is, how long is that going to take? It's a department that has had some struggles. They're facing some lawsuits that are, kind of accusing them of some pretty horrible things. And the former chief himself is facing some accusations that he was improperly receiving benefits in the name of a house that he was redoing on company time. So
the Star editorial board just took the department to task for not moving more quickly on finding a replacement for Terry Ziegler here.
Right.
Sam, another issue is local control of the police department. We hear talk about this. The city remains the only major town in America that doesn't control its own police department. You've alluded to that here. How aggressively will the mayor and the city council push for local control, which would take a change in state law, right?
Right. So there's been a more aggressive approach to this by both the mayor and some on city council this year than there has been in the past. Kansas City lost control of its own police department in 1939, a response to the Pendergast machine. It's now state controlled. The police commission, which Chris just talked about, is appointed by the governor. Now, all these are local people. It's not like they're bringing up people from Springfield, although there are those who would argue that it is not representative, the police board, of what Kansas City looks like. So the mayor and some on city council will be, this is one of their priorities with the state legislature, to go there and regain control of it. This happened a couple of years ago in St. Louis. St. Louis had the same corruption problem decades ago, but they went to the legislature, regained control of their police department. So that's something that elected officials in Kansas City, many of them, are aggressively pursuing, but that's not something that Chief Rick Smith or the command staff want. They're happy with the status quo.
So you aren't expecting this to become a hot issue in 2020, it doesn't sound like.
I think that, given the fact that the legislature, the General Assembly, a couple of years ago relinquished control of the St. Louis Police Department, seems to me that that's opened the door to KCPD, and they would be leaning in that direction. On the other hand, as you know,
didn't work out real well for St. Louis.
So far it hasn't. But the point is, we don't know what the General Assembly is going to do. But there will be a more aggressive approach by the city to regain control of the KCPD.
Interesting. You know, one ultimate goal, just to wrap up our conversation here, gentlemen, is to get off the FBI's most violent cities list in 2020. Chris, you get a sense that this would be seen as a major accomplishment if we can pull that thing off.
Absolutely. And I think the lesson I've learned, from talking to officials in Milwaukee and Tampa, looking at other things across the country, it's not outside the realm of possibility. I mean, it's possible. There, as happened in Milwaukee, New Orleans for years has been even higher than Kansas City on the annual list of homicides. Last year, I think they had a 30% drop. The year before that, they had a 10 or 20% drop. these criminal justice statistics. You can't look at just 1 year. You got to look at long-term trends, but there's some good signs there. Oakland is another kind of nationally famous example of a city that has made a dramatic turnaround in its homicides and its violent crime. And I think Kansas City, certainly, you know, if those places can do it, why not Kansas City?
Okay. Appreciate the conversation. Appreciate the good thoughts about what might be occurring in 2020 when it comes to public safety. I want to thank KCUR Sam Zeff. Sam, thank you.
My pleasure.
Chris Haxel, connected with the Guns in America Public Media Collaborative. Chris, always appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk about McDonald's and whether black ownership of McDonald's franchises, how that changed the trajectory of black economics in the last 20 years. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Subscribe to Kraske Off Mic to receive highlights and my thoughts about topics discussed here on Up to Date. Go to kcur.org/Kraske, and my weekly newsletter will show up straight to your inbox each Monday. Don't wait. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. On Friday, our film critics are back for a look at what's playing in local theaters, and they'll give us a review of the snubs and unexpected nominations for this year's Oscar Awards. Join us on Friday for KCUR's Up to Date. Well, think of fast food restaurants like McDonald's, and these days images of low-wage jobs and unhealthy food can lead to obesity and even diabetes spring to mind. But the relationship between McDonald's and the black community is a little more complicated than that. The restaurants have come to represent a source of economic opportunity and political power. Following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1968, entrepreneurship became a means to racial equality, and African Americans began to see ownership of fast food franchises in their own neighborhoods as one way to achieve that. The federal government under President Nixon saw it that way too and chipped in to help. By the late 2000s, black-owned McDonald's restaurants saw sales topping $2 billion. Marcia Chatelain chronicles the black community's tricky relationship with the fast food industry in a new book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She's a professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. She speaks in town tonight, and this book, by the way, is getting glowing reviews. Professor, welcome. So nice to have you here.
It is great to be here.
You grew up dropping by a McDonald's in downtown Chicago after school many days. What do you remember about that particular McDonald's?
I remember it was two floors, so it was very large.
Wow.
And more than anything else, it had all of these wonderful representations of African-American history.
Yes.
Whether it was photographs of Martin Luther King Jr. or different tributes to groups like the Tuskegee Airmen. It was one of the places in which I saw African-American history everywhere.
This particular franchise was owned by an African-American.
Absolutely. And then later on, when I was in high school, I was in a quiz bowl show about African-American history, and the prizes were paid for by the local chapter of the National Black McDonald's Operators Association.
So your relationship with McDonald's, you have some good feelings about the franchise and what it's meant in your own life.
Absolutely. I think that as a kid, getting a quick meal with my mom as she worked several jobs to support us, it was the place where there was a lot of freedom for me as a teenager with my own money, a place to hang out with my friends. Even in graduate school, I ate a lot of McDonald's as I was working on my dissertation.
You know, this story begins in, of all places, Missouri, Ferguson, Missouri, to be specific, and the site of those protests following the killing of Michael Brown back in 2014. Why did you begin your story there?
I wanted to start my story there because I think that the McDonald's on Florissant Avenue really represented what McDonald's has meant to a lot of African-American communities. It is a place that remains open and consistent even in the midst of chaos. And so much of this story begins in another moment of uprising, and that's Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968.
And how Memphis responded.
And all around the country, whether it's in Memphis or Chicago or Los Angeles. And I wanted to think about the ways that the fast food restaurant has been a place of refuge in times of crisis, and why that is a challenge for us today to think about.
You know, the McDonald's in Ferguson was a black-owned McDonald's franchise, and the owner was a descendant of what you describe as a somewhat bizarre and incredibly powerful marriage between a major fast food company and the fight for civil rights. Why do you describe this history as somewhat bizarre?
Well, I think when we think about the civil rights movement, we often think about the gains around voting, around housing, some access to integrated education. But business was a really large turning point, or rather focal point, of the movement, especially after King's assassination. And it was that move towards black-owned businesses that created the setting for McDonald's and then later other fast food companies to recruit African-American franchisees and really expand in African-American communities.
So it was King's assassination that led the leadership of McDonald's to begin to realize that, hey, having some franchise owners who are people of color might be in our benefit.
Right. There were concerns because a number of white franchise owners no longer wanted to do business in predominantly black neighborhoods. And so they were given the opportunity to franchise in predominantly white areas, and it opened the space for African Americans to come in.
No question that McDonald's viewed this idea of black ownership also as a way to expand in the civil rights era. There was a personal gain recognized there.
Right. I think what they were recognizing was that after King's assassination, particularly the pivot away from movement goals that were based on integration, which had really failed on so many levels, and this idea of black empowerment and black economic development was a place that both liberals and conservatives could converge and support. Liberals liked the idea of some type of economic mechanism available to African Americans, and conservatives, who particularly did not want integration, didn't see this as a threat to their communities and neighborhoods mm-hmm. if African Americans had their own economic vehicles.
And to what extent did McDonald's see this as a way to sell more hamburgers?
Well, what they realized was that in a market where there were fewer and fewer businesses as a result of what I call economic white flight, that they could have a captive market. And during the oil embargo crisis, what they also realized is that in the inner city, people were more likely to walk or take public transportation to McDonald's versus the suburbs, in which people, because they were rationing fuel, were not going to drive to McDonald's and waste gas. And so those factors also helped McDonald's stay strong in inner cities in the 1970s.
So keeping those franchises open and operating was seen as in the best interest of McDonald's.
Absolutely.
Corporate leadership saw it that way.
And what they also had was not only the support of the federal government through subsidies to open franchises and minority business opportunities, but they also had support from major civil rights organizations that felt like the pivot towards black economic empowerment was where the movement was going to go. And it's this moment of deep poignancy.
So Democrats, Republicans, everybody on board with this idea.
Because it felt easier. One of the things that concerns me is when we look at the history of responses to civil unrest, whether it's in the early 20th century or Ferguson, Missouri, the people who are most affected by these moments say, we need better housing, we need quality jobs, we need to end police brutality, we need better health care, and we need more business options. And it seems like business is the place in which people focus a lot of energies to the exclusion of these very critical issues.
So if Dr. King was asked if he would have approved of this marriage between black franchise owners and McDonald's, he would have said yes.
I'm not entirely sure about that. I think what Dr. King would have...
But he liked the idea of entrepreneurship.
He liked the idea of using the economic boycott as a measure and a tool to ensure African-American civil rights. And in his last oration, he talks about the power of the black dollar to not only make demands on the economic system, but to promote good jobs, safe jobs, and opportunity. So I think he would have some critiques about the industry's wages, about access to health care, and the larger structural issues.
So just before we leave this point, so was McDonald's making an altruistic decision here by getting more African Americans involved in ownership, or was it a self-serving one?
I would say it was self-serving, but I do think that African American franchise owners tried to use their position as business owners for the larger and greater good of the community, which has been a feature of African American business people since the 19th century.
My guest, we're visiting here with Marcia Chatelain and her new book, The Golden Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She'll be speaking at 6:30 this evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. You know, one of the key players in the recruitment of Black owners for McDonald's franchises in the wake of Dr. King's death was a man named Roland Jones, who was a Black store manager at a McDonald's in Memphis. Tell us about Roland Jones.
Roland Jones is from Memphis, and he managed a store in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And he was among a small group of African Americans who were able to enter McDonald's at the manager level. He was a veteran, and he said that he didn't know McDonald's until he started working for them because of the deeply segregated way that he lived in Memphis. And his responsibility in terms of recruiting Black franchise owners was to see people who were connected to the community, who were trusted figures, who could recruit people, who could make sure that the stores operated, but also were able to jump through the hoops that were part of the franchise recruitment process.
I was going to say, he wanted people who could communicate with the corporate structure and also identify with Blacks on the grassroots level. I mean, that can be a trick.
Well, I think what this system revealed was that there were many people who were incredibly smart, incredibly talented, incredibly hardworking, but they never were able to get their foot in the door. And I think there's a deep poignancy about the men who came together to start the National Black McDonald's Operators Association, because they were people who were representative of a generation of African Americans who knew their own potential, but saw very few avenues in which they can exercise that.
Jones' search led him to a man named Herman Petty, who was a military man. He became, I think, the first Black franchise owner. Who was Herman Petty?
Herman Petty was from Chicago, from the South Side. He had been educated at Roosevelt University in the city, and he was that perfect mix of someone who was respected. He had been a barber. He had some education and had a deep interest in starting a business. And when Jones met Petty, he said, you know, this is the guy. And he reopened a store in December of 1969 in Chicago that had been closed after King's assassination.
So with the help of white capital, Herman Petty gets this first Black McDonald's franchise in Chicago. Right out of the gate, he had a deal with a gang called the Blackstone Rangers that threatened to undermine the business. What was Herman Petty up against there, and how did he navigate that tricky situation?
In many communities that had a strong gang presence, the gang created a mixed bag of experiences. While they could sometimes intimidate or scare locals, they also had a responsibility to protect territories and corners. They had sometimes very symbiotic and sympathetic relationships with businesses. And so one of the things that Petty talks about is making sure that the gangs understood that they couldn't bring a lot of mayhem to that particular store, and that they could kind of collaborate and work together for the best possible situation. And I think that that anecdote really reveals the ways that people had to negotiate constrained conditions because they were left behind because of racism and because of poverty.
I was going to say, what other obstacles did Black owners tend to face?
Well, they tend to inherit older stores that were in disrepair. They had to...
In neighborhoods that weren't the most affluent.
In neighborhoods that didn't have a lot of capital, they had to deal with the racism of the lending and banking industry. And so sometimes they had to use alternative means of financing. They also had to deal with a corporate culture at McDonald's that had a vision of a franchisee as a white man from the suburbs who had access to capital and access to opportunities. But one of the things that happened very quickly was that the success of the Black franchise owners forced the corporation to understand the Black consumer market differently and to provide some tools for support for this group of franchise owners.
Why were those Black-owned McDonald's so successful? Because they were. The numbers are pretty impressive.
They were successful for a number of reasons. One, I think, is because the fewer competition that was left in some of these communities as a result of businesses leaving, the fact that it was a very low-priced product that a lot of people could access. And the other element of it is that the growth of African-American franchise McDonald's happened at a moment in which buying black as a symbol of racial solidarity as well as political power was capturing the attention of a lot of people. And so for many, they believed that going to a black-owned franchise was buying black, and people were very interested in supporting African-American business owners.
So Herman Petty was the beginning of black owners at McDonald's. How many McDonald's restaurants today are owned by African-Americans?
I believe the number is in the 200s. Last time I looked, there was an article recently in Business Insider about some recent concerns about the number of black franchise owners that are leaving the McDonald's system because of various pressures that are put on them. And when I look at a story...
Pressures like what?
Well, one of the things that's challenging for African-American franchise owners, even when they're very economically successful, is that they often own stores in communities in which doing business is higher. And this is higher cost. And so this is where we see the discriminatory legacy of things like redlining, of insurance rates. So you can have a profitable McDonald's, but if it's higher, if it's a higher cost to insure, a higher cost to secure, if you are also contending with the corporate office telling you that you have to redesign your store,
right,
that you have to bring in more products, that you have to have endless refills, all of these things cut into the bottom line. And I think it is exposing that even in systems that allow for some African Americans to become very wealthy, discrimination is still there.
Hmm. But the point with these restaurants moving into black ownership, this is why you say that this is when fast food became black, to use your words.
Yeah, I use that term to talk about the fact that even though fast food is a ubiquitous feature of American life, what it means to different people in different communities changes as a result of race and class. And so sometimes when I talk about this book, people say, well, everyone goes to McDonald's. And I said, yes, everyone does go to McDonald's. But what it means in a community when that franchise owner is also the person who's giving the most jobs to that community, who's paying for the youth sports in that community, who's ensuring that there's a scholarship opportunity for youth, then that franchise has a different role. And I think it's important to understand that role if we are going to get serious about helping people make different dietary choices, to have as many opportunities as possible. We can't put the weight, I believe, of what should be happening in a large, robust public system on any business.
I was going to say, that's the rub you just referred to, is the health downside to fast food. What are you seeing? How is the community reacting to that as the years pass and more attention gets paid to this idea of the health downside to fast food restaurants?
Well, I think that as the fast food industry expanded, it was really criticized, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, about the health content. And the Surgeon General reports were coming out and saying, you know, this food isn't good for people. And so they've adopted menu items that are marked as healthier. And we can have a sense that there's some fast food that isn't as bad for you. But I think the market of fast casual has also upended our ideas about food and health. And so McDonald's is now in a crowded field of places that are relatively cheap for people to eat. And so I think it complicates their relationship with communities that had fewer food choices in the past. But one of the things that I think is important to always remember is that it's more than just the food. It's about the community. It's about the connections. It's about the memories. It's about the affect of what fast food can provide that is also a factor in why people support fast food or have an issue with fast food.
So to what extent did the black owners respond to this community need and become a place for people of color to gather for meals? You mentioned as a little girl seeing some of the history up on the walls of the McDonald's in Chicago that you used to visit. To what extent did black owners embrace that idea of building community through McDonald's?
I think the black franchise owners up to today really embody the spirit of black business owners from the 19th century, that whether it's an African-American funeral home or an African-American restaurant, that those businesses weren't just about goods and services. They were also about that person having the political power to intervene on behalf of people with the judicial system, or that person being able to give small loans to families that were in need because the banks wouldn't. And so in that same vein, African-American franchise owners are visible visible members of their community. Mm-hmm. People know who they are. They see them on local television. They hear them on the radio talking about things like voter registration, talking about things like health screenings. And so in many ways, I think that McDonald's was very smart in that even though it's a rather rigid company, right? If you ran out of burgers, you can't start selling hot dogs there. So they have a formula, but they understood the power of the franchise owner in the community, and they allowed for flexibility in African Americans choosing what charities to support, what their philanthropic message will be, and allowing them that type of space in order to cultivate the community that became very loyal to them.
Well, you know, Marcia, you know, can you make any judgments here about how effective Black-owned franchises prove to be in terms of lifting African-American communities across the country, or is it just too hard to say?
Well, I think the judgment that I make is that there are African-American-owned businesses that have had an incredible impact on African-American people. With that being said, I do not think that is the role of business, that I would prefer to live in a world in which a business can exist, but we don't rely on the business owners to make sure if that person goes to college or not. We don't rely on that person to...
It's not a realistic expectation, you're saying.
And I don't think that's the role of a corporation, because at the end of the day, a corporation wants to make money for itself and its shareholders. Mm-hmm. As a public, we want to make sure people have healthy choices and options to make every day, safe places to live, healthcare, good schools for their children. That's the role, I think, of civil society, not business.
Is it true that Black-owned McDonald's franchises have typically out-earned their white counterparts?
They have. And the period of time that I capture in the book really looks at how their early performance of these Black franchises are amazing. They do outstanding work.
And they surprise corporate ownership,
they,
I'm sure.
They surprise them in terms of their ability to earn. But one of the things that the franchise owners grapple with is that even though they are making good profits, they have to advocate for themselves in terms of getting advertising space devoted to the African American community. They still have to advocate when they want more than two or three locations when they want to expand. So even though they are quite successful, throughout the organization's history, they are advocating to be able to feel like full members of the McDonald's franchise system.
So what's the bottom line then for McDonald's when it comes to its relationship with the Black community? It strikes me as more than just a little complicated.
Whoa. I mean, yeah. I think the bottom line is that if corporations exist and have such influence in communities, then we need to understand that influence in order to provide alternatives to that particular corporation's offerings. I don't think that we need a landscape in which every business has to be Black-owned in order to have a successful society. I'm more concerned about what happens to the workers and the people eating in that restaurant mm-hmm. after they leave that place.
How did you get started on this idea in the 30 seconds we have left?
I thought it was interesting that my first engagement with African-American history, which I've studied and published about, my first book was about the Great Migration. First time I read about it was in a program that was sponsored by Chicago area Black McDonald's Operators Association members.
And that idea got churning in your head here.
It got churning in my head.
Marcia Chatelain, again, her new book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She speaks at 6:30 tonight at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Nice to visit
and
with
I'm a proud Mizzou graduate, so please come.
Oh, good for you. That sounds good. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. You can find previous episodes of Up to Date at kcur.org/up to date, like yesterday's conversation about adulting with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Still to come this week, our indie documentary and foreign film critics are back with a preview of what's playing in local theaters. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.